I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, teaching the Iraq War in high school classrooms. But first, as many as 24 people, including at least one American soldier, are believed dead after a suicide bombing at Bagram Air Base, the main U.S. military base in Afghanistan. Vice President Dick Cheney was visiting the base at the time, but he was not hurt. A purported spokesman for the Taliban is claiming Cheney was the target. But U.S. military officials say that's unlikely because Cheney was at the base unexpectedly overnight after bad weather delayed his plane, a military C-17 named the Spirit of Strom Thurmond. Well, joining us on a cell phone from the Afghan capital, Kabul, is Farouk Samim, who's an Afghan stringer for the Chicago Tribune. And Farouk, how far was Vice President Cheney from the site of the bombing?
Well, I have been to Bagram Air Base myself, and when you usually, when you enter the base, there are three different checkpoints, two run by American forces and one by Afghan National Police. And it is the place that the blast happened, it is like more than 1 kilometer, like one and a half kilometer far from the area where the troops are based. I think Vice President Dick Cheney was there.
Mm-hmm. Are attacks like this common on military bases?
No, actually. These attacks are mostly done by Taliban. And so it is not necessarily on military bases. But it is definitely on military personnel from foreign troops based in Afghanistan. The suicide bombers usually see where the target is. If it is near their base or, for example, in a convoy driving in a city or on a road, they attack them.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that this then signifies anything to today's attack? Does it signify a change on the part of the Taliban, do you think?
Well, this is actually like a start of the attacks that the Taliban militants promised for the spring. And from one side, the NATO has decided to defeat Taliban, and they say that the Taliban's backbone is broken already by them and they will not be able to do anything in the spring. But from the other side, the Taliban say that the recent reports say that they are ready and they have a lot of people prepared and ready to carry suicide attacks. Like in a recent report by Dadullah, one of the commanders of Taliban, who said that there are around 2,000 suicide bombers ready to carry suicide attacks, but we cannot, you know, confirm it.
And when you discussed the Taliban and you said that at least there are unconfirmed reports that the Taliban has 2,000 suicide bombers standing by, how strong is the Taliban in Afghanistan right now? Do we know?
Well, in one of my recent trips to Kandahar, which was like 3 days ago, I was in Kandahar, and some of my colleagues, former colleagues or friends from Al Jazeera International were kept for like 24 hours by some commanders of Taliban. And according to one of my friends, there were, I mean, hundreds of Taliban in the area that they were kept first, and then later they were given an interview by Taliban. So they are all, I mean, armed with the Russian RPG rockets, which is a Russian RPG launcher or rocket launcher, and they have heavy machine guns. And according to those friends, you know, those Taliban were expecting some new weapons, which they said that they would use it against air power for NATO. And there are some parts of Afghanistan that border with Pakistan, and those are, I mean, some parts, you know, completely controlled by them.
Farouk Samim is an Afghan stringer for the Chicago Tribune. He spoke to us from Kabul. Here's a debate you didn't hear on the floor of the U.S. Senate this month.
We must bring more U.S. forces into Iraq to exert control over the country. No matter how long it takes or how costly it is, we must continue to work with the Iraqi government to train Iraqi police and security forces. We must also make sure that
the most constructive thing we can do now is to work with the UN, engage Iraq's neighbors in their region, provide the resources to enable the Iraqi authorities to establish
Iraqis must resolve their own deep-seated differences and determine their own future. It is now time to bring our troops home and refocus our resources and attention in our economy and its security at home.
Those are students at Normal Community High School in Normal, Illinois, debating three options for the United States in Iraq. Should there be an increase in the number of troops there, a timetable set for withdrawal, or an immediate pullout? Today, we're taking a look at how schools are teaching the Iraq War as it's happening. First, we turn to Kelly Keough, a U.S. History and International Relations teacher in Normal, Illinois, and Heather Johnson, who's a junior at the school. They're both joining us from the studios of radio station WGLT. And Kelly, can you start by telling us how this debate works in class? How do the students go about choosing their positions?
Well, it depends. Very often, I will tell the group what option they have to defend, because very often you have a lot of kids saying, well, I don't necessarily want to take a position that I don't agree with. And as I've always invoked, those who don't know their opponent's argument truly don't know their own, but they will have to debate it and defend it, but they then get an opportunity to reflect on where they are after giving each of the options a fair hearing.
Heather, let's go to you. You were involved in this debate that we heard at the very beginning, and you were assigned to defend the position that increasing the U.S. presence in Iraq, troop surge, if you will, is the way to go. What did you say in favor of that position?
I said that making Iraq a democracy will take away the issue of the power vacuum, as well as making Iraq a more stable country, and to ensure that Iran does not try to expand its regional influence and power. Many people died defending this cause. We should honor their memory and sacrifice by completing the mission, no matter how long that it takes.
And this was different from your personal view.
Yes. My personal view is that we should give the Iraqis the means to succeed, but also to set somewhat of a timetable, and once those events are completed, we should leave.
And did you always have that opinion, or was that how your opinion evolved once you learned about the issues?
I felt more detached from the war because I don't really have anyone personally related to me who is involved with the war.
During the debate, did you hear anything that persuaded you one way or the other?
One of the questions was, by sending more troops to Iraq, do you think this would increase Iraq's dependency on the U.S.? And I thought that was a really good question, that yes, it probably would create more of a need for the U.S. to be there. But Iraq is kind of already using the U.S. as a crutch.
Kelly, I'm wondering, why is it important, do you think, to teach about the Iraq War right now as it's happening?
Our job as public school teachers is to prepare these kids for the real world. And the only way that that happens is giving them opportunity to deal with real world issues as they take place. It really gives these kids an opportunity to see that they can handle complex issues and come up with informed decision, just as they're supposed to be doing once they become voting citizens of this republic.
You know, Heather mentioned something interesting. She said before she had learned about this, she felt sort of detached from it because she didn't know anyone who was personally involved. What about the students in your class who do have maybe a family member or know of someone who's in Iraq or fighting in Iraq? How are their views different? Have you noticed a difference?
Very much so. Heather was in one international relations class who had two students in her class who have family members serving in Iraq. And in my other class, there were seven kids who have family members. And all of them responded saying, initially they started off saying, let's increase our position, stay the course, is what the president has been arguing. And then once their family members were in country, they didn't necessarily see the merit in the mission anymore. And all these kids have moved to the point of saying either we need to set a timetable and get out, or get out now.
I'm wondering, if you're not supposed to be, necessarily arguing your own opinion, so you can learn your opponent's opinion and really understand. How do you think, Heather, that your teacher's doing in terms of keeping his opinions out of the debate?
I think that Mr. Keough does a really nice job of giving us the material and keeping his own opinions to himself.
Do you think you know where he stands in terms of his position on the Iraq War?
Actually, not really, no.
I had to pay her big money to say that, though.
Well, how do you try to make sure that your opinion doesn't sort of influence what's happening in the classroom?
It's a challenge. It definitely is. I mean, this is not an issue that I take lightly, nor do my students. And as I said, these aren't speeches in the forum here, some academic exercise. This is real life stuff. But I've always tried to do my best to say that I need to be an honest broker here, that these kids have been told what to think their entire lives, and a lot of them just want real quick answers. Well, what should we think? I'm like, no. You have to start thinking for yourself. You have to have the skills and the ability to think critically because, again, problem solving is a major part of what we're trying to make these kids to be when it comes to being effective citizens.
Heather, what was the hardest thing for you to sort of get your head around in all of this?
I think that the hardest part was learning that the U.S. took action based upon our national interests, and sometimes there's not always a clear-cut right or wrong thing to do. Like, before the Iraq War in the 80s, we supported Saddam Hussein because Iran was the worst of the two poisons. And now Saddam was a threat to our national interests, so we took him out of power.
In going through all of this debate and realizing that it's a very complicated issue, and you know that lawmakers are doing this in Washington, does it make you respect what they have to do more?
I think it helps us to understand more of what they're going through and the values that they have to have in mind, and that they still need to respect public opinion as well as make a decision that's best for our national interests and as well as international interests.
I actually read to the class the foreword from the Hamilton Baker Report, the Iraq Study Group, where it said this country needs to debate this issue. And that's right there in the foreword. So as I point out to the kids, what we're doing is not only necessary, but it's been warranted by this leading Blue Ribbon Commission about Iraq.
Kelly, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Kelly Keough's been teaching history and international relations for 21 years. Heather Johnson?
Yes.
Thank you as well.
Thank you.
Heather Johnson is an 11th grader in Kelly Keough's class at Normal Community High School in Normal, Illinois. When we come back, we'll talk with the group that designed the curriculum that Kelly Keough used in his class to encourage debate on the war in Iraq. And later in the show, several Western states show Washington the way on greenhouse gases. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. We've been talking about bringing the debate over a troop surge in Iraq to the classroom. Since 9/11, the Watson Institute for International Studies at Brown University has developed teaching materials about the terrorist attacks and their aftermath. About one-third of U.S. schools are using these materials, and this month, the Institute released a new unit on the Iraq War. Joining us with more is Dr. Susan Grasick. She's director of the Choices Program at the Watson Institute. And Susan, first of all, can you put it into perspective for us? Why does your group feel that it's important for students to engage in this debate?
You know, I was watching the In Memoriam, George Stephanopoulos, on Sunday mornings. And last Sunday, there were more than 30, I think it was 33 soldiers whose names were released last week. And they were ages 19 to 40. This is an issue that our high school students are living with. This is not only their future, it's their present. And there are people in high schools who know people who are over there. Their families are over there. Their brothers are over there. Their sisters are over there. Their friends are over there. Furthermore, they're about to graduate. And for a lot of students, this is one of the questions. Are you headed there too? So I think students need to have an ability to own that issue, to be able to feel that they understand what the issue is about and can get kind of a sense of ownership for it rather than just being thrust into the middle of current events.
What about some of the resources that the Choices Program recommends that students use when learning about Iraq? Where do you recommend they go to get some of the background information?
For starters, the curriculum unit that we've developed on this has got background material with it, readings that deal with the questions of Sunnis and Shiites going way back for centuries. There's material in this curriculum that's dealing with the changing politics of the Middle East. So all of this is there. But in addition, if you're going to have more time to spend on this, we have made links from our website to a number of fairly carefully vetted sources.
And you also have students check out what bloggers in Iraq have to say?
We do. There's a lesson plan in here that is Blogging Baghdad, I think we call it. The idea being that we have so little access to Iraqi voices these days. So we've taken some specific excerpts and made a lesson plan out of it so that students can be trying to understand how do you figure out what the source is, where the source is coming from, what its point of view is. There are a series of questions there to ask. The blogs are actually listed in the teacher's resource book, not in the student text, with a bit of a warning to teachers that you should always go and look at where you're going to send students before you send them. We're not in a position to be watching those blogs every day and seeing that, oops, today isn't a day that probably I want to send 16-year-olds to the blog. That's up to a teacher to pay attention to.
You also, there's part of the program that encourages students to evaluate the rhetoric that is used in discussing the war. Can you explain that a little bit so our listeners can sort of understand what that is?
This is a topic that is very controversial, to wit, the way in which the Senate is having trouble talking about this now. It's a highly charged issue. And highly charged means there's going to be rhetoric around it as well. And you want students to understand something about rhetoric and understand something about the way in which people use language to talk about an issue. What we're trying to do in looking at this issue is not to wipe out the controversy of the issue. We want students to understand this controversy here, but we want them to be able to clarify the controversy and wrestle with the differing views that are there, and then ultimately to come to their own conclusions on it.
How do you think teachers can present it as impartially as possible so students can make up their own minds?
I think ultimately the question for teachers on an issue as controversial as this should be, is there room for students to figure out what they think in a substantive and well-informed way, but to figure out what they think on the issue? And I don't know that that necessarily means that a teacher needs to hide what they think themselves, nor do I think it means that a teacher should necessarily present their views. I think ultimately the question for the teacher is, how am I going to create an environment for my students in which they know that what they think matters? And it's not a question of trying to find the answer that I have for them.
When we first contacted Kelly Keough, the teacher in Normal, Illinois, who we just heard from, who's using this curriculum about the war in Iraq, he said that it was difficult to make students care because many of them are more concerned about American Idol to some degree. So how can you get teachers to help engage students and make them care about this? Even when we heard from Heather at first, she said, you know, she was sort of detached from what was happening in Iraq because she didn't feel that it really affected her personally.
I think knowing something about the issue helps. There is nothing more disempowering than feeling that you just don't understand. And so, for instance, when we developed this curriculum, and it's not just options, there was a whole set of background readings and lessons and so forth that go with this. The idea is to give students enough material that they really can wrestle with it. They do know something about it. They do understand something about the issue. And, of course, it's not easy to start that process, but that's what good teachers do. They bring it alive for students.
And do you have something similar for what's happening, say, in Afghanistan?
We have curriculum material dealing with a range of issues. We have curriculum material that's dealing with the issue of terrorism. We developed it right after 9/11 and have been updating it ever since. We have material that deals with the Middle East in general. We have material that deals with quite a wide range of international issues. There's not one specific to Afghanistan. There's a broader unit that we have that we've been continually updating to keep it current on the U.S. role in a changing world. And that one covers a lot of issues. It's sort of the way that students can start to think about, well, what do I really think about our country's role in the world? And that can be applied to a lot of different issues.
What do you hope the students overall will take away from all of this?
That if they are a citizen in a democracy, then it's their job. It's not just their right, it's their job to be thinking about what they ultimately think about tough issues like this and to make those views known.
Susan Grassick is director of the Choices for the 21st Century program at Brown University's Watson Institute for International Studies. Susan, thanks very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, is Jesus buried in a suburb of Jerusalem? We'll speak with Bruce Feiler, author of Walking the Bible, about the debate surrounding a new documentary called The Lost Tomb of Jesus. Also, a young filmmaker from Kosovo comes to the U.S. for his work and finds Borat fatigue. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The governors of five western states say they plan to do what the federal government won't. They're taking steps to reduce the greenhouse gases that cause climate change. Arizona, California, New Mexico, Oregon, and Washington State have agreed to develop a regional plan to lower greenhouse gases with a so-called cap-and-trade program. It's the latest in a series of moves from states, businesses, unions, and lawmakers to try to take action on climate change. Well, joining us from Washington to talk about this shift is John Fialca. He covers energy and environmental issues for the Wall Street Journal. And John, let's start with what these Western governors are doing. What's behind this move?
Well, I think they want to create a consensus for a regional effort out there. There may be a hidden agenda here in that they want to push the federal government to do something that it hasn't done up until now. A lot of the big industrial players here don't want to see a patchwork quilt. If there's going to be a system, they want it to be a national system. And so this may be pushing that a little, too.
Mm-hmm. Is there a goal or a percentage reduction that the governors, if we start with them, are saying that they would like to see in this proposal?
I think they're in the formative stages of this.
Okay.
As you may know, New England and New York have a similar regional effort. It's devoted only to power plants. I think the western one may be broader, but it could well be that before the western one gets there, you may see federal legislation.
Hmm. Can you explain a cap-and-trade program for us just briefly?
Yeah, basically, for every ton of emissions that you produce, you have to have a government certificate that says that allows you to do that, and then gradually the government lessens the numbers of certificates. What some people see as the beauty part of this is that the certificates have a sizable cash value and can be traded. And so if I am Company X and I have reduced and invested in pollution technology and reduced my emissions below the threshold, then I have excess credits I can sell. And if Company Y can't make its tightened quota, it has to buy them. And so it's a way to kind of finance your pollution control efforts. And a lot of companies tend to like this because it's very close to what they do, which is trade.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And the point then being that it would be a way for companies to meet these goals.
It's a more flexible way than just commanding, you know, you should do this by such and such a time. And it's more appealing to the people who have to actually do it.
Right. Also, it's my understanding that there are three major energy trade associations joined by the AFL-CIO that are pushing for nationwide regulations. And these are groups which previously opposed any federal mandatory caps on greenhouse gas emissions, but now they say they changed their minds. What happened there?
Well, there are two groups of utilities, the big one being the Edison Electric Institute, that people who make most of the electricity in this country, and there's the American Gas Association. And these are nationwide trade associations, and they want to be part of this debate. Previously, they said they weren't interested in federal mandatory programs, but I think they've begun to realize that if they're not in this debate, they may have something imposed on them that they don't like. And so they're coming in for probably the most moderate of the five bills that are before the Senate, and they're trying to stake out a position that they can defend.
And that was basically what you were referring to at the beginning of our conversation, that they don't want a patchwork of things happening. They want to make sure that they have a say in a uniform legislation to deal with this issue.
Well, as one of them put it to me, electricity doesn't stop at the state line. The flow of their business is national. And so if you have a balkanized system in this country, it's harder for them and more expensive for them to deliver fuel or energy to your house. Mm.
And what about overseas as well?
Well, that again, you get into, you know, can one state or one region do anything about this? It's a global problem, first of all. And if you remove emissions anywhere, you've helped a global situation. And if you increase it, you've increased emissions around the world. So you need most people who look at this say you need national programs, and on that basis, then you can begin to trade these emissions credits with a much bigger market overseas if you've matched them up correctly.
Hmm. Now, also, it's my understanding there are, what, five separate bills on Capitol Hill, somehow related to climate change. Can you explain what those are? Is that sort of the national way to go that you're talking about here?
Well, there are five mandatory bills before the Senate. Four of them would cover the entire economy, which would include the transportation sector and cars, which is a particularly tough problem to control. And one of them would just deal with power plants, which is much easier. They're all in the kind of fledgling stages in that they haven't been fleshed out, and we don't know really what they cost, except that the amount of emissions they cut varies across the board. Some would just trim the growth over time. Another one would take us to, by 2050, they want to go 80% below the level of CO2 emissions we had in 1990, which is a really drastic cut.
Hmm.
And so Congress has to weigh these things, particularly what they'll cost and what they'll make people do. Because all of these will increase the consumer pays, of course, at the very end of all of these things, and they will raise your energy bills.
Right. So how likely is it that we would see anything from Congress anytime soon, do you think?
Well, there are two schools of thought on that. One is that these industrial groups we were talking about and the labor unions want to see this issue settled soon, and they want to play a role in it, and they want to get this over with. The business groups want to see what they call certainty. If I'm going to invest in a power plant that lasts for 50 years, I want to know right now what kind of power plant that should be. And so they want it sooner. There's some suspicion that there are Democrats and environmental groups who would rather wait until after the 2008 election. So they might have a more friendly president in the White House and get a more restrictive bill.
Mm. And just briefly, we have about 30 seconds here, John. There is precedent for legislation implemented by the federal government to deal with issues like this, right?
Indeed. The Clean Air Act and its amendments were enacted after states and regions began moving, and it created the same angst among industry that we're seeing now, that they didn't want a patchwork system.
All right. Well, John, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
John Fialca covers energy and the environment for The Wall Street Journal. Later in the show, after 50 years, a journey back to the African desert called the Kalahari and a reunion with the Bushmen who lived there. You're listening to Here and Now. The college cafeteria and gourmet dining are not usually thought of together, but a creative Yale University student is trying to change that. When sophomore Zach Marks goes to the Yale cafeteria, he pulls together several standard dining hall items, mixes and matches, and voila, culinary creations that aren't on the menu. Zach writes about his recipes in a monthly column in the Yale Daily News, where he shares his advice about how to eat well in the university cafeteria. And Zach joins us on the line. Welcome.
Thank you.
So share basic advice with us. What do you do to help improve cafeteria food, maybe give it a little zing?
Well, I think it's all about your creativity. You know, Yale doesn't have bad food by any measure, but like students at all schools, I think sometimes you get dining hall fatigue. You know, you walk in and the cafeteria is having a bad night and all that's out there is dry chicken breast or bland spaghetti, and you want to liven it up a bit. So I think that's really where the fun begins. You take the walk down to the salad bar, you grab some veggies that look good, throw together some condiments, and after some experimenting in the microwave, you can turn salad bar staples into dining hall delights. And I think that's really what the column is about, and I think really anyone can do this. Certainly my friends who have never cooked before have begun having some fun with the microwave and are learning how to faux saute their vegetables with a little bit of olive oil. So I think that's really what it's all about.
So give me a staple that is now one of your staples in your Dining Hall Delights menu of dishes.
Sure. Well, my favorite recipe is Thai peanut satay. When I entered the dining hall one night, I was thinking, you know, I could really go for some Thai food. And all I saw out was tofu scrambler, vegan shepherd's pie, and some grilled chicken breast. So rather than resign myself to a dinner of raisin bran, I tried to make a little satay. So I took some peanut butter from the peanut butter and jelly area. I took some soy sauce and sesame oil from above the salad bar. I threw in a little bit of honey from the tea and coffee station, and I mixed them together and threw them in the microwave. And after some experimenting, I had what I was pretty content to call a Thai peanut satay, and so I skewered up the chicken breast, put it on some toothpicks, and there you were.
Oh, very good. So what about, though, sort of a trick that you do in the dining hall with standard items that you tend to use in multiple recipes? What would that be?
I think definitely it's the faux sauteing. So when you're cooking in the dining hall, you're not blessed with a stove and pots and pans. So when you want to make something out of some vegetables, you have to saute them, as it were, in the microwave. One thing that I've been working with, I tried this the other night, was a little etouffee by faux sauteing some celery, onions, and peppers and a whole lot of butter in the microwave. Then you thicken it up and you see what you get.
So where did your enthusiasm for cooking come from?
I've always been into food. I think my first experiences in the kitchen came when I was 5 or 6. I wanted a new bike and my dad suggested that I pay for it. I wasn't really sure how to raise capital as a 5 or 6 year old. So I started a little food business. And so for one summer, every weekend we'd drive to farm stands in central Pennsylvania. And we'd grab some fresh fruits and veggies and make pies and stews and such. And we'd sell them to our friends, and that raised enough money to buy a bike.
I'm wondering if you could tell me what sort of response you've gotten to this. I know that there was a recent article in the New York Times about your culinary creativity, and you write a column, as we said, for the Yale Daily News. What's happening?
I've been contacted by students across the country sharing their favorite recipes. So, you know, I'll get an email from someone saying, "The food of the University of Tennessee is god-awful. Thanks for being an inspiration. I tried your recipe, and I'm definitely going to start playing around in the dining hall more and not giving up on the bad dinner." And in fact, what's been really fun is that I think this really isn't so unique a thing. I think students all over are used to experimenting in the dining hall, and whether it's making pita pizzas or something like that. So there's certainly been a lot of response from it, and I've been enjoying it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you're going to be a chef?
I'm not sure I want to be a chef. It's definitely, I definitely love food, but I think I really love food for its ability to bring people together and just sit over a nice hot meal and talk about everything.
All right. Well, Zach, thanks very much for speaking with us.
All right. Have a good one.
Zach Marks is a sophomore at Yale University and a cafeteria gourmet. You can check out recipes for his dining hall delights at our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now.
If you look at a map of Africa made in the 1940s, you will see in the southwest portion of the continent a sparsely inhabited bushland about the size of Spain. Within this is the Kalahari Desert, an area of about 120,000 square miles, much of it as seemingly empty as the Antarctic. When in 1950 my father, Lawrence Marshall, was looking at such a map in Windhoek, then a frontier town with unpaved roads, a government official told him that the place he was viewing was the end of the earth. No white person, he thought, had ever been there, and no Bantu person either.
That's writer Elizabeth Marshall Thomas reading from her new book, The Old Way, A Story of the First People. That unmapped area of Southwest Africa in the 1940s is present-day Namibia and Botswana. And that was exactly where Elizabeth Marshall Thomas's father wanted to take his family during the 1950s to visit the hunters and gatherers, or the Kalahari Bushmen, who had lived there for centuries. Elizabeth's first book about the Bushmen, titled The Harmless People, was published in 1959 and has never been out of print. She has written other books as well, including the bestseller The Hidden Life of Dogs. But in her new book, she goes back to the African desert to tell the story of what happened to the Bushmen in the decades since the Marshall family first traveled to Africa. Elizabeth Marshall Thomas joins us from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio. And Elizabeth, tell us about that first experience that you had in Africa. You're 19 years old. You went to an unpopulated area of Africa with your family to find the Kalahari Bushmen?
Yes, we did.
Why?
Why? Well, my father loved the idea that there was no map. The place was unmapped. And there were only three places in the world at that time that were still unmapped: the Kalahari, interior of the Kalahari, Antarctica, and Tasmania. And he chose the Kalahari as a place to go.
Hmm.
And then what? Why go there? Well, he thought there were people there. It turned out there were these Bushmen, and very little study had been done of them. So his object became to go there, find them, see if they would agree to talk with us and let us live near them, and then to do our best about making films and making a study of them. They agreed to let us visit with them, to let us camp there, and we soon became friends, friendships that have lasted through three generations and will be as long as any of us are alive. My brother made it the purpose of his life. My mother continued working there until she was in her mid-70s. My brother made a huge collection of films. His last film is called A Kalahari Family, and it covers the time from the 1950s to the present and shows what the difficulties the people face now. Mm. And I wrote my first book, The Harmless People, about these people, and I was only in my 20s when I finished it, and it does not cover many of the things that I later decided were very, very important. And that's what this book is about. And it was really an experience to write it.
In the 1950s, what was that world of the Kalahari Bushmen like and your experiences there? Just give us a brief sense of that for those folks who may not be familiar with that, and then we can talk about your revisiting. What was it like then?
It was an enormous, pristine wilderness. And the ecosystem was completely undisturbed. It was as it had been for 150,000 years or more. That's what we found. We found an ecosystem of which people were an integral part and yet had not destroyed it. And it was a most amazing and beautiful, beautiful, beautiful place.
Tell me what the people were like. You have different stories about marriage and how men and women acted. And also you have an interesting story about jealousy and the emotion jealousy. What really stands out in your mind about the people, the Bushmen of the Kalahari?
Any species that lives in the old way, their primary concern is survival. And so it was essential to them that they did not arouse the jealousy of each other, that they shared everything equally, which they did, religiously shared, that they didn't have leaders, no one person bossed anybody else, everybody, they got to things by consensus, to the point that now that people don't like voting. I mean, voting is sneaky. They would do it if they have to, and they do, but it's not right. I mean, you do go and do something in private, and nobody knows what you're doing. Nobody knows who you're voting for. You can't. You know, it's distasteful. And I would have thought voting was sacrosanct, but I get it. I understand why they don't like it. Yeah.
Tell us about what you found when you went back.
Their land had been mostly taken away. A huge area in the north had been removed and became a game park. A big area in the south was removed.
So the government took the land.
The government took it. Mm-hmm. The government took it. And the way of life is impossible now, and there's no place to do it. And there are no hunter-gatherers, and the skills have been lost, and so forth and so on. The government had also established a post, an outpost, at a place called Chumkwe. And alcohol had come, drugs, diseases. The people in the past, they were really a very healthy people, but that came to an end as they got exposure to others.
Are there lessons that you think people should take from the story of the Bushmen of the Kalahari?
There certainly are lessons, but I don't think we're going to take them. The idea of what the people wanted, the Bushmen themselves wanted to do, was to keep their homes as they did in their traditional way, but instead of hunting and gathering, they would have cattle and plant gardens, and they would have permanent water with the help of the wells. Wells were dug for them. Elephant barriers were put up, but the farming has not received the help that it needs. This is what the people mostly wanted. They wanted to be rural Namibians. And you can't expect a young African guy to dress up in skins and go bow hunting in Stone Age technology when his contemporaries are, if they hunt, they have rifles. I mean, it's just not, things don't work that way. So the urge for them is very strong to be perhaps farmers or to join the mainstream of Namibian life. And I hope that they will.
So the way of life, the old way, the title of your new book, that's yes. Gone, really.
For people, it's gone. Other creatures live it, of course, still, but we don't.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel in any way somewhat responsible for what may have happened here, because by writing about the culture and interacting with the Bushmen, that this drew attention to them?
Well, I've been asked that question before, and I really don't know how to answer it, because there is no area on the face of the earth that quote-unquote civilization hasn't overrun. There is no way that place could have remained
unknown
as it was. Mm-hmm. It is not possible.
So there are no more unmapped areas of the world. What would your father do if he were raising children now? Where would he go?
That's a good question. It's a good thing he lived at the time that he did.
Well, Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, thanks very much for speaking with us.
You're very welcome.
Elizabeth Marshall Thomas is author of the book The Old Way, A Story of the First People. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, and Virginia Prescott. Doug Sugertz is our engineer. Our web producer is Ken George. Our interns are Austin Mayfield and Emily Reddy. Our managing editor is Chris Ballman, and the senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. Robin Young returns tomorrow. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.